complete charge of the Kutztown Folk Festival, there were at least, I'd say, at least maybe 15, 20 people who were not in agreement with EBI's way of doing things and taking it away abruptly. But EBI was a shrewd lawyer and he knew how to do it. So some of these people said, well, we won't help EBI. We're not gonna go along with this. And that was the beginning, really, of our society here. First, we met just in private homes. We just had little social gatherings, like on a Sunday afternoon and Sunday night supper and so on. And finally, well, if we want to do something, we have to get organized. And that was the beginning of this society.
Who were the main organizers?
Well, I was one of them, my husband and I. And then there was Louis Schlossberg. Now, Louis Schlossberg worked for the Reading Eagle, and he was the publicity man for Shoemaker. And when Shoemaker had to go to New York to get the newspapers to, put things in the newspapers, he always took Louis along because he said Louis knows how to get his foot inside the door.
Uh-huh.
And he was one, and then Paul Wiand. I don't know if you heard of Paul Wiand or not.
Yeah.
Paul Wiand was from Lehigh County. He was a teacher in the Allentown, he was an art teacher in the Allentown Public Schools. But he was very, very good in art. He was also well-versed in all kinds of herbs and teas and stuff. In fact, he wrote a little book on that subject. And now then, Paul, of course, was interested in making money. So he had a little country store on the folk festival, which he operated and, of course, paid percentage over to. But he was one of the main ones. And Dr. Yoder. Dr. Yoder was with us from the very beginning, 100%.
Was he in Philadelphia then? Did he come up
yes,
from Philadelphia?
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Yoder didn't show up at our meetings anymore. He went with EBI.
Oh, okay. I bet he regrets that now.
Huh?
I bet he regrets that now.
Right. Well, I don't know. You know, where money is involved, there are no regrets sometimes, and sometimes there are.
I thought he'd broken away from them now.
Well, he broke away from the Scientist College. He's very much involved now in the Pennsylvania German Society.
Yeah.
He's the editor of their publications. But he went along with EBI, and he had more to do with stage programs. And Fry had more to do with the music end of it.
Did Fry go with you?
No. Well, Fry, very unfortunately, you know, there was a polio epidemic when so many people got polio and there was no way to fight it. His wife was in an iron lung for years and years and years.
When did you first form the society?
65. There hangs our charter.
Okay.
We're 65 years old now. 30 years old, I mean to say.
And this was your first building?
Oh, no.
Oh.
No, the first building, the first thing we did, remember when we started, we didn't have a nickel. Nothing. No money. So we had to find ways to raise money, and we also had to find a way to let the public know who we are and what we were aiming to do and so forth and so on. So our first project was the one-room school, which is down beyond our buildings here, and it's owned by the borough. And that was on its last legs. when my husband and I passed here, we always talked about it, that this was going to go down, down the drain. And so then, after we were organized, well, we must undertake a project. So I suggested restoring the one-room school. Well, it was owned by the borough, so we had to negotiate with the borough council. At first, they just laughed at us and said, oh, who would be interested in this? So that was close to 1958, when they built a consolidated school at Crumsville. And they left a junk man come in and take out everything that was in it, desks, everything. But the building was there, the plastering was falling down, the windows were broken, the pigeons were on the attic, the roof leaked.
Right.
It was really very, very close to not being salvaged anymore. But then finally we convinced them and they said, well, we'll do it on the outside. We'll waterproof the gable and we'll fix the playground and you do it on the inside. So that's what we did. That was our first project. And we had it open to the public for 20 years.
And did you come on weekends or did you have somebody there every day?
No, during the summer we were there every day.
Okay.
And for 6 years we had the school in session live with a former one-room school teacher and live pupils, and they were in colonial costume like they were dressed in those days, and they used the old books and they carried on just like they did in the one-room school. It was a dramatization of the one-room school, and we did this for 6 years, and we had people in there, you better believe it. Then we had trouble getting teachers. They all said, we're getting too old, we can't do this anymore. And we have kids, no problems. At first people said, you can't get the kids to come to school during the summer. They had enough school during the winter. Well, when we found out, you know, who some of the families were, we contacted them. And then we also bribed them by giving them a very nice bus tour late in the summer. We had them to places like the Philadelphia Zoo, the Statue of Liberty, the Capitol at Harrisburg. One time we were up to the Poconos to a playhouse, and for 6 years we did that. And then our teacher said, well, I can't do this anymore. This was very strenuous on the teacher to keep the kids under control. Even though the enrollment was maybe somewhere in the neighborhood, 10, 12, 15 kids,
yeah.
And talking to the public.
Yeah.
This was
yeah.
It was a little more strenuous than your average daily routine.
Did you ever teach a one-room school?
I went to a one-room school as a child, all 8 grades. I took the course at Kutztown. In those days, you had an option of taking primary, secondary, or rural. And I took the rural course because I was raised on the farm and I figured I was going to teach in a rural school. And I did my practice teaching in a rural school in Maxatona Township.
But then where did you end up teaching?
Well, in Greenwich Township area, there's a little village up the road here called Kleinsville.
Uh-huh.
It's not there anymore. The schoolhouse was taken away, it was bulldozed when they built I-78. I have a slide of it yet, a picture.
Huh.
And then...
But that was a one-room school or not?
That was a one-room school. Then I also was up there at the Sugar School, which is up on the 737 on the road up to from Crumsville over to Kempton. And that's where I went to school as a child, and I taught there. And then the last 2 years of teaching, I was out at Christ's. Now that's out there at, how shall I describe it? Where you go around the bend, it's made into a house now. It's near what they used to call Grimm's Old Mill, if you know anything about that. Well, it's...
Actually, I live on Grimm Road. Is it in the Maxitania?
No, it's Greenwich Township. But then I got married.
Oh, okay.
I should have stayed there. I had only 14 pupils. I didn't know what to do with myself almost. But anyhow, then I got married, and I thought, well, this is it. And my husband already taught in that one-room school right there, and that Dr. Sheridan painted for us.
Oh, okay.
That's over Northampton County near Stuckertown. So we got an apartment over there and started housekeeping. And I wasn't there very long in that area. Then they came and asked me to open the Belfast School right after Labor Day because the teacher was sick. So I said I'd help out, which I did, and I was there. And then in October they came and said, well, now Mr. Yeisley is able to come back again. Well, that's fine with me. So I stayed home. And he was only there a week, then he died. Then they came for me again, will you finish the term? So I did, and I was there 5 years. And in the meantime, though, my husband was, of course, looking for greener grass, too, and he had put an application in Easton, and he got a job in Easton. So he commuted, but in those days they didn't plow the roads like they do now, and so he had trouble getting back and forth because sometimes he had to even stay down with other teacher friends for fear he wouldn't get there the next morning. And he said, well, we gotta move closer, this is enough of this. So we moved to Easton, and again I quit teaching. I thought, this is it.
Yeah.
Then they found out that I was a teacher, and they called me for substituting, which I did at first, and I hated it. And then I said, now if you can give me a full-time job, okay. If not, forget me. Well, because my husband was already in the high school in those days, maybe it did help a little bit, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, I had no trouble getting a job. So I was there 13 years yet in Easton, teaching first grade.
Right.
And then he had retired 3 years earlier already. He had 38 years all told, because he was a little older than I, and because I had lost some time in between these movings, I only had 25 years. So that's my teaching record, 25 years. I have a little pension, but not a full pension. But I was very much interested all the time in the life of the one-room school, and that's how we began to accumulate these books. And when these retired teachers, they had things at home, and they'd say, well, this is going to be burned up, and we want you to have it. And I was very receptive to take it, and we accumulated a lot of artifacts and books and so forth pertaining to the one-room school.
You know, some people tell me that, you know, I guess I still run into people who went, I guess they were only in their 50s and 60s and went to one-room schools. And some of them say they think they learned more than their children did in the consolidated school.
Well, if you compare it with, this is what I am so thankful for, that I had the privilege of teaching in the one-room school and teaching in the city school. So I know the difference pretty well. And this has changed so much since, see, I retired in 71 already. But even then, there was such a vast difference between the city school and the country school. In the country school, the teacher was the sole purpose, the sole person to be the administrator, There was a county superintendent, there was a school board, but they could care less. That teacher had the power to promote and to put the children where they belonged. If a pupil was poor in arithmetic, in the grade that he was ordinarily, you put him back into another grade for arithmetic class. Maybe he's a very good reader. Well, he might read a sixth grade level. You put him into that reading class. You had the power and the ability to change them.
Yeah.
You know, the funny part of it was when we had restored this school, we got a call one time from administrators in Philadelphia. And they said, we would like to come, have a committee come up to meet with you and some of your teachers to find out where we're going wrong. We can't reach these kids in Philadelphia. So that time, Mrs. Dietrich lived yet from Hamburg and all different ones. And so we had quite a meeting that afternoon. They had a tape recorder, and I don't know what happened, whether they learned anything or not, but we told them what we were doing and what we did in the one-room school.
Yeah. I don't know, they say they're thinking more of that kind of broad, kind of holistic.
Well, now then the trend came to divide the children according to grades. Well, that's what we did in the one-room school. But also the beautiful part of it was that here you had all the grades, little ones in the front, farther back, pickings. And those little kids sometimes, let's say third and fourth grade, they were sitting there and you thought they were daydreaming. But they weren't. They were listening what was going on at the blackboard up front. And when they got into that grade, they were just one jump ahead.
Yeah.
Also, the preparation was terrific. You had to be prepared with all the different grades. This was not coming to school like they do now and wait until the kids are in this class and then walk in. You had to be there a whole hour ahead of time to get your work organized. If you didn't, you had all kinds of bedlam.
Yeah.
So, those older ones sometimes were finished with their assignments and they were allowed to come front and help the little ones, extra help which the teacher didn't have time for.
That's what I heard. That worked, actually. That worked well.
Oh, it worked beautifully. Absolutely. If you would ask me which I should, if I had to put in an application, would I want to teach in the one-room school or the city school? Well, you know which one I'd say. But then it would have to go back to the times when the teacher was the sole person to make the decisions.
Yeah.
When I was in the city school, we had standardized tests and this and that and the other thing, and somebody in an air-conditioned room that never even saw the children decided whether this child was going to be promoted or not.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't work. But now I don't know if I could take it anymore because of the rowdiness and the kind of life that's going on with these kids. See, the lifestyle of the home has changed so much.
Well, you know, they say a lot of city kids, they don't see, there's not a lot of support for the schools. They see the schools as a farm or an alien institution.
Well, and also there's no support from the home. Now, these children, I taught in the city school, and I know even with first grade, sometimes a child would come to me, when are we going to the cafeteria? Well, no, it isn't time yet. We have to do this or this or this. Are you hungry? Oh, yes, I'm so hungry. But didn't your mommy make breakfast for you before you left? No.
Is most of the people that you went to, when you went to school and that you were teaching in the one-room schoolhouses, did they see education as important? Did they see that as...
Yes, more so, and especially, now my parents, I'm taking it from there. My father could read and write, but he wasn't very fluent in writing a letter or anything like that. My mother was still worse. She only went to third grade. And they wanted to be sure that I had gotten more education than they did.
Yeah.
See, my father had to help support the family. He worked during the summer on the farms as hired man. During the winter, he went out into the woods with the loggers to chop down trees and haul lumber.
There was still logging around here.
Oh, sure, in those days. My dad was born in 1878. And my mother only went to third grade because my grandmother's health became very bad. And there was a big family. And my mother said she had to learn to bake bread when she was 9 years old. She had to stay home from school and bake bread for the family. My mother could never talk English either. I always criticized her for it. I said, you must try. Well, I can, she kept saying. And now my dad took a stab at it, Dutchified and mixed up as it was. But he took a stab at it, but my mother wouldn't. She just didn't learn.
Huh. And there were enough people around that she could communicate?
Oh, yeah. All the farmers, everybody around here in the neighborhood and church and everything else. But then she was self-educated in reading. She could read the newspaper, even though she only went as far as third grade. I have her reader on the shelf there. And she went as far as third grade in the reading class, but herself, she taught them to read the newspaper. Good enough that she knew what was going on. Now, how will this fit in with your course?
Well,
it won't fit in at all.
We'll see.
We're going off the tension here.
Right. I never know how things will fit in, but one of the things I talk about
came along, and that in fact, if you give me a minute, I have about after we had organized, we knew we would have to do something to raise money. Well, that time the Allentown Fair was held every year. And Paul Wynn said, I can get you into the fairgrounds and get a stand in there. And Louis Schlossberger, he was connected with Reading, and he was connected with, more or less, with Bosco.
Uh-huh.
So our first project was with Al Bosco. He had a whole week which he called Dutch Days. And we did all kinds of things in there. We had the run of the whole store. We made funnel cakes in the lobby. We had demonstrations of making chow in the children's division. You know, they made room for us.
Yeah.
And then they built it, even his crew built a little replica of a one-room school. We had one of the one-room school teachers in there with kids, and even when people came to shop at the store, they could dump them off in the one-room school. Now, this is the story of Flax.
You knew somebody still knew how to, does anybody know how to do this yet?
Well, at the crafts people at the Hemetfest, they do spinning and weaving.
Right.
Now, these pictures were taken in Cooperstown, New York. My husband and I went up there to Cooperstown, and this man gave an excellent demonstration of what has to be done to the flax after it's grown in the field. And then these numbers are the numbers on my slides that I can identify them real easily.
Yeah.
at the back road here, Emil and George's. They had a red carpet party. See, years ago, the women saved the strong part of the garment when some was worn out, and they cut it into strips. Then they sewed it end to end, and the neighbors got together to help to do this. And this was a party. This was a red carpet party. This was a social time, and they had refreshments and gossip and whatever. Then the carpet rags, the balls were taken to a man who had a loom, and this was Henry Fry up near Kempton. Then later he had his shop in Kutztown. And here he takes some of these balls and wraps it on this thing here. And then he sits at the loom and throws the shuttle back and forth, back and forth. Now we have a big loom down but we can't use it because it's so old, and we were told not to use it to demonstrate because it would fall apart.
Now this guy was in Kutztown.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. When did he
Highland come? Avenue, I think.
Huh. What happened to his loom?
Pardon?
Do you know what happened to his loom?
No. Oh, no. I have no idea.
Now, was he doing this as a hobby, or was this a real
business? Oh, no. That was his business.
That was his business.
The people would take these balls, like you see there, and then this is the kind of carpet that he turned out. And they would get their own balls of rags back again in the form of carpet, but this was a big roll. Then you had to measure your room and cut it into the size of your room. Some were basket makers. This is the story of making willow baskets, and there's a little place called Basket, PA. And that shows you how he grew the willows down in his meadow. Then he had a little country store. And if he had no customers, then he made baskets. He had to strip off the bark, and he tied them on bundles and stored them upstairs until the winter time, till he was ready to work on the baskets. Now there you see some of the baskets that he has ready for sale. And during the summer, he went down to Reading with a horse and wagon and sold the baskets. Now this is splint basket. This was a willow basket. This is splint basket. Guy had to go out and chop down a young oak tree. This is in the Ole Valley, Freddie Beaver. Freddie Beaver worked right in his kitchen and made baskets and sold them.
That's the schnitzel.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's the beginning of the forming of the basket.
Huh.
Now the broommaker. The broommaker lived in Fogelsville, this particular one. Broom corn grows in the fields, and then it has a tassel. It doesn't get ears. It has a tassel, and then when it's grown to maturity, you have to bend it over so the tassel hangs down straight, or you'd have a thing like that. These are two types of brooms. The splint broom we have down in the museum, that was made from oak trees, and this is the corn broom. And this is, his name was Willie Falk of the Well Care.
Again, this wasn't something just for a show.
Oh, no. This was right in his shop.
But this was his livelihood.
That was his.
That was
the only livelihood he had. He lived right in Fogelsville.
About what year were these taken?
Now there.
Remember what year?
Oh, well, I can see it on the slide. I don't have them in here, but I can see it on the slide. I'd say sometime in the 50s.
These are good pictures.
Well, now the color doesn't come out like in the real slide. His real slides, the color is very nice.
Yeah.
But when you transfer then you lose some.
Well, it looks, these look good, especially for the 50s. Boy. Was he using a big camera or was he 35?
Oh, he had a 35 millimeter. The first one he bought was in 1952, I believe, something like that. And not automatic, he had a light meter.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why he got good pictures. Now everything is so automatic and you don't get the good results anymore.
I know, but actually I trust the automatic more
than I trust myself with
a light meter.
It worked like this. When he bought the first camera, I wanted to learn how to do this too. And you know what happens between husband and wife. We got into arguments. So I said, from now on, you take the pictures. Now this is Willy Falk, and he has some of these for sale. He probably did these custom. You see, the people took their corn, broom corn, to his shop, and believe it or not, you see the different colored handles there. They oftentimes saved the broom handle from the old broom and took it there, and he told us at the time a new broom handle costs a nickel. But if they took the old one there, they could save that nickel. Now this is pottery. This is Potterelli.
Oh, Stahl pottery.
This is Stahl's pottery. Now this is Russell Stahl. He's not living anymore either, but there were the two old fellows, Thomas and Isaac, and their father already was a potter. But Thomas and Isaac, we learned to know quite well. But then when they got old and died, this Russell was one of their sons, and he was in the service. Then when he came back from the service, he tried to bring it alive again, but he couldn't make enough money. So, believe it or not, he bought the Fredericksville Hotel and was in the hotel business.
He was just a little bit, I think Breiner does all right at this.
I don't know. Now there's a picture
maybe
of
maybe just a little bit too early.
This is the kiln, how they loaded. Each piece had to be put into a form so they didn't touch each other. And there were such openings like this, four around the kiln. Now this thing was bought by some of the descendants recently. And they had a demonstration.
It was
more or less a family reunion, but also a festival. It's called Potter Valley. Now this is candle making. Now these are Moravian candles. This fellow was a teacher. He's still living yet. A teacher in Emmaus, and he knew this man. So he said, this man makes the Moravian candles for the Moravian church for their Christmas Eve festivals. I'm going to start a series on food specialties, and I have those with the CVS, so that's where I take them to get them converted.
Oh.
This is a drying house. This is something that Kutztown ought to have. I learned what a drying house was up in Canada for the first time.
Hmm.
But we found others here in Pennsylvania then later too.
This would be dry food to keep it?
Yes. Corn, string beans, fruits, vegetables. This is apple butter cooking. Those are with the Kodak company too, smoking and meat. This whole series I'm going to develop on food specialties and preserving food.
Oh, that would be great.
Don't have it done yet.
These are really great.
It runs into money a little bit, but this I expect to bring to the library too once I get it more completed.
Yeah.
And then I want to index everything more thoroughly, and so
well,
I have plenty
really
of work
here,
plenty of work on hand that I can find work to do.
Well, I think you caught the last stages of, I mean, people do this for demonstrations anymore, but actually to be doing it for a living, you've got the last
I don't know. I do it for a hobby because I want to save these things and I want to make them available to the future generations.
One thing I wanted, you said one of the reasons you told me you're moving over to the society, over to the university, it's harder to get younger people involved in this?
Well, yes. Now, when we started here, we did everything with volunteer. We had no money. We did everything with volunteer. But we soon picked up business during the summer, and we couldn't get enough volunteers anymore. So we had to start paying the tour guides, paying those people, which, of course, in the early days was a very nominal amount of money. And sometimes some of the women brought their children along during the summer when the school was out. But now you can't get volunteers at all, no matter how, because the women all work. They have to work to support the family. Living expenses are too high. So you can't get younger women anymore to do that volunteer work. Furthermore, the older ones are very spoiled. I'm very truthful about it. I'm a senior citizen too.
Yeah.
But you know why the senior citizens don't want to do it? They get Social Security and don't have to work. They don't have to come here and sit in this heat.
Right, but still they have plenty of free time. They have Social Security.
Well, there are a few now and then that do it because they like to get out, and it's very, very rewarding. Even Jean here now, I'm sure she wouldn't have to do it. And
no,
she's,
it's just that I think, although maybe when I'm here, I myself can look through the book.
She
add something to mine.
That's right. It's an education for her, and
I don't get to my other libraries. I have to get out to Kutztown. I'm a member of the Genealogical Society. I never get there. I don't even get down to the Berks Historical Society anymore. Terrible. So once a week, I get here anyway.
Well, we're most grateful for her. She's very dependable. When she says, I'll be here every Tuesday, she'll be here.
Yeah.
It won't be a matter of calling up and saying, I can't come, unless there's a very, very special reason for it.
Yeah.
But that's the problem today. And the rest of us are all getting older. And we thought we were taking the right step. In fact, this was all done according to parliamentary procedure at our annual meeting, that they voted to go through with this merger, but we're waiting and waiting, and nothing is happening out there.
No, well,
this librarian that you have now, the head librarian, I wrote to her one time. I forget just what I asked her, whether they had a certain dialect, because as she wrote back, she said, we only have 8 entries in the dialect in the card catalog.
Yeah. No, but they're building, even, you know, they didn't even have the Pennsylvania German Society collections, and they've got those in the last couple of years, but they didn't even have their, you know, the collections.
Do they have the complete set?
I don't think they have the complete set yet, but they're getting, they had nothing when I first got there, and now they've got,
hello.
I think most of the stuff since 1960.
Well, would I be bothering you if I did some typing now, or should I wait?
Let me see, she's good. And then we have another boy who was here before. He graduated last spring from Gettysburg College. Couldn't have a job. So he works for us part-time. But now he has his name in for substituting at a lot of places. Hopefully he'll get some ins that way. I don't know. He was valedictorian in his class and puts in the Hamburg High School. Bright kid.
Yeah.
And just can't
he'll
get a job.
Some. It takes a while sometimes.
Well, he says, he went to Gettysburg and he did his practice teaching in Hanover, you know where that is. And he says if he talks to the people around here, these school officials, they never heard of
Hanover.
that, those areas down there. And he doesn't want to apply for a job down in that area because he's has a fiance, wants to get married,
yeah.
And he's waiting to get married. In fact, they would be married if he'd have a job, but he doesn't want to get married till he has a job.
At least you're getting, those are younger people you're getting.
But he is, then we had another young fellow from Kutztown, he's a student out there. He just lives right over across the highway here. He was here before, in fact, his mother works out there, Jill Miller. Know anything about her? She's in the office of, do they have to do with supplies? She orders supplies and stuff. Well, anyhow, when she went to high school, she was one of my kids helping here. Mm-hmm. And we took her along to the Kutztown Folk Festival when she was a high school kid. Now, this is her son.
Right.
But he was here for a while, but now he went with the painter and he gets $10 an hour from the painter.
Yeah.
So we can't afford that.
Okay.
So Tim Dugan,
he
wants to become a minister.
That's right.
Something
in
the religious line.
Yeah, and I think he worked here for a while.
Yes, he did. He worked. Well, this is how it started. See, in 92, it was 92, yes. When we signed this agreement, that our intention to move, the reason we signed the agreement more than anything else was because we had trouble getting tour guides. And Kutztown said, oh, we can deal students, we can get you tour guides. We're going to give them credits. Then you can get a tour, we'll supply the tour guides for you.
Well, how are they going to do this?
They were going to give them credits for working here.
This is what Pileska said.
Well, somebody did. I don't know who. I won't quote Pileska. I don't know if it was McFarland or who it was. I don't know. But anyhow, they couldn't get any kids to do this because the kids wanted money during the summer. They didn't want credits. They wanted money. So they couldn't get any. Then Bloom, do you know Dr. Bloom?
Yeah.
Well, Bloom said, I still have some money in my department that I can use, and I can get you some students, but then we'll have to pay them, and I'll see they get paid. Well, he had his secretary put posters all over the bulletin boards and everything. He got us 5 students that summer. 5 students, and they paid them all. He paid them out of his college. Well, the second year we had 3, and Tim Dugan was one of them.
Okay.
We had those 3. Last year we had 1. This year we had 1, but we didn't get this Miller boy at all through Kutztown, and nobody paid anything from Kutztown. We pay them all. So that's how it worked with Kutztown.
Yeah, I'm afraid I can't do much for them. I'm a real low Indian there. I'm nothing. I'm not a chief. But I thought, I thought it was a great idea to do something, bring something about Pennsylvania Journey.
Well, I have been saying this for a long time already. Here, Kutztown is right in the middle of it, and what do? Absolutely nothing until this thing started up, and this is how it started with Pileska and this cultural center. See, when we got our charter in 65, our attorney said, now you must bequeath your assets to somebody in case you would disband, who would get your collection, who would get your property. Well, then our board, he hauled around and went, who are we going to put on there? And that time, Landers Valley was being developed by the Historical Commission. The Historical Commission had money at that time, and they were doing a real good job.
Yeah.
So then our board said, well, why don't we put them on? And maybe if we can make, nobody thought this would go 30 years.
Yeah.
They all thought, well, this is just a wild fad, and then it'll dry up. Then they said maybe they would come and take this over. Well, we didn't even talk about it anymore. We forgot all about it. And we have members in Harrisburg by the name of Kirkpatrick. Dave Kirkpatrick and his wife were teachers in Easton when we were over there. But now he got involved with the PSEA, and they live in Harrisburg. And she's pretty high up in computer. She goes to factories and all these places to teach them how to use the computer. Well, anyhow, he came here one day and he said, now, you know, the Historical Commission would not accept your gift here. I said, they wouldn't. Well, he said, unless there's a great big endowment coming with it to support it. Well, that means we don't have that.
Right.
Okay, we got to do some thinking here. What are we going to do now? Well, then we try to contact different organizations. I contacted Reverend Drugenbrode. He was president of the Pennsylvania German Society. And now we're a publishing company. We're not in the museum business. Then we contacted, we sent Anna Stein as a delegate down to the Berks Historical Society. And she was well received by Harold Euler, and he said, but I'll bring it before the board. You'll get a letter. Well, the letter came and said, we do not want any interest in your properties. You're too far away from Reading. Also, you have too much real estate. We're not interested in real estate. So that was that. In the meantime, though, Kutztown somewhere or other was getting wind. This got talked around. And they came and they said, well, now, we have this farm, and we'd like to develop this farm into some kind of a museum and make use of this farmhouse and these buildings. So that's how to what we would have that you would want to read, but you're welcome surely to come and sit. We have books on practically any subject imaginable, and the Pennsylvania German Society, you say you have those out there.
Yeah.
Do you have the fracture, the big one?
No, I am that myself, so.
Well, I had them all but four, my husband had them all but four volumes, and I hunted high and low to get those four volumes. Finally, I found a second-hand book dealer that said he didn't have them, but he could get them for me. They were in cahoots with somebody else.
Yeah.
I paid $440 for those four volumes, but
wow.
I wanted them because I wanted the whole set.
Get the whole set, yeah.
And then he brought them here, he delivered them, and then I said, how much is the whole set worth now that it's complete? Well, now this was about 6, 7, 8 years ago already. He said $4,000. So I imagine it would be more now by this time.
Sure.
And then again, it depends who wants to buy it. But we don't want to sell it. We don't.
Yeah.
It was just curiosity when I asked the question.
Yeah. One thing in your collections there, the farm equipment, how did you go about collecting that? Did you just go out to farmers and?
Oh, no. My husband went to sales. And then lots of it was donated. When once they knew what we were looking for, people would say, well, now I have this and I'm gonna donate it if you have place for it. And at first when we started out, we had the farm equipment that we had in garages, we had it in barns, we had to get out of one place because the farm was sold. We had it up there at the Ida Bunn's house in the barn, rather. Then they sold that when she died. Then a guy made a winery there, and he wanted to use the barn for his winery bottles and stuff. We had to get out, and finally we said, now it's high time that we make use of this stuff on our own property. So we built that little temporary, we call it a barn, but it's just simply a shell to put it in.
The other thing, when you first started collecting things in the 50s and 60s?
We were organized in 65.
But you and your husband were out.
Well, my husband and I, he liked to go to sales. And that time you could buy a lot of things at sales reasonable for 25, 50 cents. which was in our pocketbook range.
Yeah, right.
And if he saw something that he was very much interested to show how something worked, the life of the people. This whole collection, it does not have paintings on the wall or artifacts worth $500,000. It simply is to show how the people live, the humble farm type people.
Yeah.
And when he'd find something, and we had a house in Easton with a second story, which was intended by the builder to put an apartment up there, but we didn't want an apartment. So we had everything stored on the second floor. And that was all right and good. But when we moved to to Topton, we got into a much smaller house.
Yeah.
We had to either sell it or donate it. Well, we didn't want to sell it, so we brought it here.
Did you, in the 50s and 60s, was there a lot of, that was the time when it was really, I think, professionals who were collecting more than...
Well, yes and no, but I'd say there were not very many antique dealers. Now you go to a sale, you can't get anything that an antique dealer wants. He just bids, 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 and you have no chance in a haystack.
Yeah.
But in those days, there were not that many antique deals around.
But there were DuPonts, right? There were the big collections that
stuff. Also, and I'll tell you how else my husband got some of this stuff. We got to know a lot of people, and one thing, if you could talk the dialect, you had your foot in the door. If you couldn't talk the dialect and knocked on the door, they looked down and they didn't even open, or if they did, you didn't get inside.
Yeah.
But if we started talking the dialect, you opened up. Now, when we got to know people, sometimes somebody died and the house was cleaned out. What did they do when they cleaned out the house? They put it on the garden, out in the backyard, ready to put a match to it. And when my husband met with those people and talked to them, he said, would you mind if I would look through that? Oh no, that's all old junk, we're going to burn that up. And a lot of it was in there that they called old junk, but we didn't call it old junk because it fitted right in with some of the categories of things that we were looking for.
Right. Yeah.
And didn't cost us anything.
So he was well acquainted
with the rural area. His father was a veterinarian, and when he was a young kid, and all through high school, he traveled with his father during the summer and got out into the farming areas.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to me that's just the time when people were realizing the value of these things, but it was really more collectors.
Yes, but they didn't. What we wanted to have these things for is to link it up with maybe something that we already had that tells the story of how it was done.
Yeah.
But they call it old junk. Oh, I must be ashamed to sell this old junk. I wouldn't think of putting this on the sale.
Yeah.
I collected a lot of needlework that way.
Yeah.
There was oodles and oodles of needlework sometimes dumped right out in the open. There was oftentimes even snow on the ground that my husband had to dig around in the snow to find what he wanted.
Yeah.
And then the books, now, this is how it worked with the books. You know, these books, even today, they put a whole lot of books into one box. And he went through them, and when he found one book that he wanted, he had to buy the whole box. But that's what he did to get that one book.
Yeah.
And then when we moved to Topton, we had to take all our unwanted books up to the book barn at Tatamy, and we got $1 or $2 for a whole box full of books that nobody wanted.
Yes.
They weren't worth anything.
Right.
But the one book that he wanted,
he got it.
He got.
Yeah.
So that's how
really
things
good.
Were.
Thank you very much.
Oh, no mention.